Can I get rolling here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so thanks everybody for coming. Thanks Ron and Karen and Seymour for having me. Title of my presentation is a psychometric analysis of patient-reported outcomes in chronic kidney disease. I'd like to say that this is a kind of a dry run for a dissertation, PhD dissertation proposal I'm going to give next week. And so format's a little different than if I just sort of conducted a one discrete study. It's a little broader, especially in kind of the setup for it. I am going to present some initial results, but kind of wanted to get that out there. And if there's any feedback you have, be particularly receptive, knowing that I'm going to be presenting this to my PhD committee or something like it next week. I'd like to acknowledge everybody, the PhD committee, several of you here, and folks who contributed data. So start off talking about, you know, so think about how we measure health. Most commonly, reports of patients' health are confined to like physiological and biological indicators like creatinine, and kidney disease is a big one, clinical indicators like disease-free survival. And while these are really important, they don't tell us a lot about how patients experience their own health and healthcare. So to better understand health and healthcare from a patient's perspective, we need got off track here. We need patient-reported measures, and these include patient-reported outcomes, which is a more common term that people use a lot now. But the FDA defines what, you know, I think this covers patient-reported measures as well, in a report of the status of a patient's health condition that concerns a condition that comes directly from the patient without interpretation of the patient's response by a clinician or anyone else. Just a real brief history of patient-reported measures. I'm starting in the 80s. There's probably self-reported like Carnoffy and stuff before that, but you can think of the medical outcomes study through the 80s and the early 90s as one of the first big systematic efforts to really develop and disseminate a great deal of patient-reported measures. This generated the SF-36 and 12 quality of life instruments that we all know quite well. After that, there's certainly a proliferation of patient-reported measures across different disease conditions and for a variety of constructs. And so in the 2000s, kind of mid-2000s, as part of their roadmap strategy, NIH funded the PROMIS, Patient-Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System, to help standardize and create sort of best of the best type of measures, help bring some standardization. There are a lot of different measures being used and things like that. Started out with tons of items, 7,000 items, created lots of item banks from that, and generated many measures, dynamic ones, computer-adapted testing, but also short forms. And the PROMIS 29 is probably what looks most like what we're familiar with the SF-36 type of profile quality of life measure. Some of the big innovations from PROMIS were, as I said, these item banks constructed of legacy measures to really generate the best of the best measures out there, application of item response theory, which is kind of a new approach in, compared to, well, it's not new, but it was a new application in the health field to facilitate more reliable and brief measures that could be done in a computer adaptive setting, the way that like the GRE is or something like that. And they also made it part of the protocol to examine measurement equivalence or differential item functioning is the most appropriate term under IAT for many of the items. And that looks at whether or not the standard measures that everyone wants to use work the same for subgroups of different patient populations. Does the measure, you know, read the same and get the same standard responses that it should from different racial groups, different ethnic groups, different languages, different clinical populations?
John, before you go on.
Sure.
The first bullet, just the way you briefed it, it may sound like it was just taking existing items.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
That's sort of more starting point, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good, very good distinction. That generated completely new measures. It's not just a transformation of old measures.
What paper is it?
Well, proprietary issues are the selecting the items that can include any variance of it.
Sure.
So, thinking about kind of shifting gears and thinking about all the different patient-reported measures that are out there, the MOS Medical Outcomes Study generated a very nice conceptual model where they listed the types of measures, patient-reported or not, and we can start identifying in this some of the key constructs and dimensions of what we know as quality of life, functional status, well-being is there. That's not the only outcome. There's also satisfaction or experience with care, which they included. And then there's all this other stuff over here under structure of care and processes of care. But these also include very important, potentially patient-reported measures or constructs like health habits, health behaviors, beliefs and attitudes about health, and preferences for health. With any patient-reported measure, you can kind of break it down into generic, which is applicable to all disease conditions, patient subpopulations. It's for everyone. Or targeted, which is the other side of the coin, targets a particular, say like a health-related quality of life instrument that's for chronic kidney disease patients only. They'll have very relevant symptoms and things for them.
You could also stratify it into CKD and non-CKD.
yeah. Absolutely.
Inside the kidney.
Yeah. So CKD, just a little background on it, is a health condition, impacts nearly 15% of the entire population of the United States. So many people are affected by it, with over 675,000 in full renal kidney failure. There's been wide use of patient-reported measures in CKD in general, and excellent measures have been developed, including kidney disease quality of life measures, the CAPS, patient experience measures for in-center hemodialysis. Those are just a few examples that are targeted. But there's been kind of less of the large-scale systematic measurement system kind of coordination, I would say, which isn't to say that there isn't a great deal of activity and measure development, but compared to something like, reaching out of promise, where there's, say, for neurological conditions, they have a NeuroQol, which is a suite and set of measures kind of all aimed at that condition. And in oncology, you have these systems of, functional assessment of cancer therapy, and the NCI has a steering committee on health-related quality of life and things like that. I would say that there's less sort of just centralized coordination of what patient-reported measures are out there. And so one of the things I want to do in this project, I guess overall, is to kind of take a first step towards thinking about what would a measurements information system dominated by patient-reported measures and CKD look like. What would be the first steps? And I think the steps I would take would be to look at a theoretical framework that helps us identify what potential types of measures we need along the continuum of care, not just at the outcome stage. And then assess the kind of take stock of the measures that are out there to use, and the goal would be to help communicate to clinicians and decision makers and applied researchers. Here's a series of kind of recommended measures that are out there and easy to use in the following ways. The specific aims are to describe the psychometric properties of extant treatment decision making, medication adherence, and health related quality of life measures in the CKD population. To examine measurement and variance for each measure by race, gender, and other key patient demographics, and based on the results of AIMS 1 and 2, to make recommendations for improvements or alterations of the measures. So the MOS conceptual model is great in that it gives a lot of good detail on the types of potential patient-reported measures that we might think about, but I wanted to think about, in addition to that, how are these potentially, what are the causal relationships, or how might these the constructs we're measuring impact each other. So I turn to Anderson's health behavioral model of healthcare access, and which describes some of these potential causal relationships. And it also helps us think along the continuum of care, what are the types of blocks of things we want to think about. And so one of the first things are what, in MOS was more like patient characteristics, is here called population characteristics. And that includes beliefs, attitudes, and preferences about health. Now, those impact health behaviors. What are the treatments that we seek? Do we use our medicines? Use of health services. And obviously, that goes along to impact outcomes. Outcomes, health status, both perceived and evaluated, as well as reports of experience of care, consumer satisfaction. Now, this version of the model is like 1994, a little old, but you know, I think it encapsulates pretty well a lot of the types of things that the MOS conceptual model has, shows what the potential relationships are. So I first want to start talking about some potential measures we can look at under this sort of patient characteristic block or category. And I'd like to kind of skip to the one I want to think about the most, which is treatment decision making. CKD patients have many treatment options available to them, and if they go into kidney failure, they have to get renal replacement therapy to live. Dialysis, or peritoneal, get a deceased or living donor transplant. But not all of these have the same benefit for folks. As you can see, this is 5-year survival, most recent data from the USRDS. In general, now this varies the type of dialysis you do, but just in general, 5-year survival for patients on dialysis is only 42%, quite low. You get quite concerned about those patients, hoping they can do better. If you get a transplant from a deceased donor, that jumps up quite a bit, over 75%. From a living donor, even more. So the benefit for those who have access to it across these different treatment types is very different. Unfortunately, dialysis is used most, followed by deceased donor transplant and living donor transplant. This is all just to say CKD patients have a large set of different, potentially difficult to obtain treatments that they can access, and they need to make good decisions about what they want to do going forward, because it has a huge impact on how well they'll do. Well, how do patients make treatment decisions? There's a lot of ways, many models, many theories. What I'm going to focus on is the trans-theoretical model of behavior change. Core construct there is stages of readiness. It articulates a series of stages from pre-contemplation to maintenance that describes how patients move through attitudinal readiness to do something like pursue a new treatment. Pre-contemplation is designed as defined as not considering getting a treatment in the next 6 months. Contemplation is next one up from that. Considering it, preparation, preparing to get treatment in the next 3 days. Action, you're doing something now, either getting that treatment or taking a big step forward, and then sustaining that action. Well, how do we get patients to do that? One thing is you can change the balance of their perceived pros and cons to whatever it is you want them to do or think about. And so decisional balance is a construct that's defined as differential weight of pros and cons of changing a health behavior. And usually, even though it's thought about as one construct, when we measure it, we think about pros and cons separately. Additionally, you can increase self-efficacy, defined as the confidence a person has to change even when confronted with challenges. By increasing the balance of pros to cons, increasing self-efficacy, you can get people increased their stage of readiness and pursue things like transplant. This graph, this is actually data from people pursuing living donor kidney transplant. Along the x-axis, you have the stages, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, and action, and you have t-scores from scales on the y, pros, cons, and self-efficacy. And you can see, even though they do converge kind of at the end when people are taking action, through the middle here, you have behavior and attitude change and decision-making change corresponds to an increase of pros here in the black, solid black, decrease in cons, bless you, through the dotted black, and then longer, dashes, thank you, self-efficacy. And so, this tells us that knowing about patients' pros, cons, and self-efficacy, yes?
Cons are going up.
Cons go down here, and then they kind of all increase as you converge towards the action. But by that time, patients are taking action, and so the trick is to get them to...
Yeah, but why does that happen? Is there lining something?
Well, so this is for living donor kidney transplant, and that... pattern might be exaggerated for this behavior. It's a scary thing, and maybe they're kind of, once the rubber meets the road, it's not hypothetical anymore. The amazing thing to validate that kind of helps us understand the validity of the model is that whether you're looking at smoking, weight loss, whatever, if you look at pros and cons and self-efficacy against stage, you basically get this pattern. more or less. Which shows us that pros and cons are good things to safe health behavior interventions, good things to focus on. We want to increase those. And they also tell us very specifically about the types of things they perceive might be beneficial and non-beneficial, or what challenges they're facing as they go forward.
Do you have specific items that really emphasize this, the cons?
We do. Yeah. We will look at those, absolutely. Yeah.
And what is the major one that is causing the pros to increase while the cons are going up?
That's a good one. I don't know if there's, from these data, perhaps I could incorporate that kind of an item level analysis to see if any particular item is associated. It's actually have access to these same items on this data set from which this graph was generated, as well as a new series of data. And so I could look at it and see if there's, there's a particular item that, I should write things down. That generates that change more than others.
This is being
a bit. Oh, okay.
So if you want to just not take notes.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, I forgot about that. Yeah. Okay, so that's treatment decision making. Now I'm going to move on to health behavior. There's lots of health behaviors we can think about. One of them is medication adherence. And so I just wanted to take a sample and critical health behavior to start looking at health behaviors in general. But this approach could be expanded to many other health behaviors. So both dialysis and transplant patients must take multiple medications on a daily basis. Common pills for dialysis patients are phosphate binders and antihypertensives. One study found that the average pill burden for dialysis patients is nearly 10 pills, so quite a bit. In transplant, there's lots of days about pill burden. There's many medications they have to take every day, but there's also sort of a huge incentive in that they have to take several immunosuppressives to keep their kidney functioning. Otherwise, they lose the graft. Non-adherence is believed to be the best predictor of graft loss after a transplant. So medication adherence is a major behavior to look at for chronic kidney disease patients. And when we think about adherence, getting into the theory of it a little bit, we can break down non-adherence into intentional non-adherence and non-intentional non-adherence. So intentional would be like, the patient has, more or less rationally decided about whether or not they should take the medication. I'm feeling better, so I've decided to stop. Non-intentional is due to not understanding the regimen or other barriers that might be out of the patient's control. They forget to bring the medication when they're traveling. These are two different key reasons.
Can't afford.
That would be a big one, right? Costs, yeah. They mean to, but they can't for some reason, or they don't. And then finally, we have outcomes. And so I'm going to focus on health-related quality of life in this dissertation, though another big one would be patient experience, and there's been a lot of work in that. We can, at its most basic kind of level, we can think about health-related quality of life as being defined as both well-being, how the person feels, and functioning, what they can do. And major domains include physical health, mental health, and social health. This is the most recent PROMISE framework. So you can see there's physical health, mental health, and social health is the sort of the largest level of domains, but within there's many, many, many subdomains. Within the field of health-related quality of life measures, there's two sort of major types. Profile, and that's like the SF-36 or PROMISE, generated by psychometric analyses, factor analyses, and captures multiple key domains of health-related quality of life separately, potentially in subscales, and maybe there's an overall scale as well. Those are different from preference-based, which come out of economics and economic approaches based on many different strategies, but they tend to capture patients' preferences for levels of health and potential treatments in sort of a single score. And so they just want like a one-shot there. And mostly I'm only going to be focusing on profile measures here. In CKD, as I said earlier, there's been lots of action around patient-reported measures and patient-reported outcomes. but there's been less of a systematic, coordinated effort to kind of bring them all together and see what we have. As I mentioned, I'm going to be focusing on these kind of, you know, large categories of measures, although there's others out there. And I'd like to walk through and sort of give a, you know, very abbreviated overview, focusing most on the measures I'm going to use in my dissertation, although I'd like to give a caveat and say that there's tons of other measures out there. With the exception of this particular sort of category, treatment decision-making, there's not a ton of validated measures out there. There's several CKD knowledge scales that are out there, little older. But in terms of validated, theoretically driven scales, like there's lots of scales, readiness scales and things like that, but they tend not to be validated. They're kind of user-created for a particular study, and they may never be used again after that. Waterman and colleagues did generate a series of TTM-based measures looking at living donor transplant pros, cons, and self-efficacy, as well as a corollary or related set of deceased donor transplant measures. And these were all found to be reliable in recent studies. In medication adherence, there's been a great deal of generic assessment, for instance, like the brief medication questionnaire. But a very popular scale, a very popular set of scales, the Mariski medication adherence scales, both 4 and 8 item versions, haven't been used too frequently compared to other disease conditions. Now, one caveat on that is there's a lot of the development, especially with the 8 item version, has been in hypertensive patients. So you may be able to look back and say, well, some of those hypertensive patients really CKD patients as well, probably. But focused efforts, there's some limitation on how much this scale or these two scales have been used. And, in general, have been cited over 3,500 times, I think. So there'd be an interest in understanding, kind of using them more and understanding their psychometric properties within CKD patients very specifically. The MSSA is what I'm going to focus on in particular. And with hypertension patients, it was found to be reliable and had predictive validity by successfully discriminating between patients who had blood pressure control and those who did not. And in health-related quality of life, there's been many generic scales used, especially the SF-36. I'd say that's probably the most common approach, although the KD-QOL measures are the most widely used targeting scales. The KD-QOL scale started as the KD-QOL-SF in 1994. Includes the SF-36 along with 11 kidney disease targeted subscales, internal consistent reliability alphas ranging between 0.76 for the sleep subscale and 0.94 for a subscale called the effects of kidney disease. And then later, a brief version of the SF was created, including the SF-12 instead of the SF-36, and used only 3 subscales. To date, I haven't been able to find any very large assessments of the psychometric properties of the SF-36, the KD-QOL-36 in U.S. samples, although there's a number of smaller studies for non-U.S. samples out there. So getting into the methods of how I'm going to start evaluating the measures here. So I'm going to look at the psychometric properties of several measures, the ones I just told you about. Within treatment decision-making, adherence, and quality of life. And I'm going to employ both classical test theory as well as item response theory. I told you about the Waterman groups, pros, cons, and self-efficacy scales. Here's a little bit more of the nitty-gritty on those. For the living donors scales, each has six items. So an example living donor transplant pros item is, if a living donor transplant, I'll be able to contribute to my family and friends sooner. They rate that from not important to extremely important. Cons works about the same way. Example cons item is the surgery will inconvenience the living donor's work or life too much. An example self-efficacy item is how confident are you that you could get a living donor transplant? And that rating response options isn't not important to extremely important. It's not at all confident to completely confident. There's a similar set of, you know, as I said, kind of mirror image items or scales for a deceased donor transplant, both pros, cons, and self-efficacy. The deceased donor transplant self-efficacy scale is a little longer with 8 items, but the ratings across each are the same as the living donor, and obviously the items are different, you know, more general about transplant in general versus targeted on living donor transplant. So I'm going to be looking at this set of 6, under treatment decision making, this set of 6 measures. For each of these, there's no reverse scoring. The raw scores or reports are summed to create scales, and higher scores indicate higher trait or ability for each of them. I got none of them are ability, but traits. So higher scores mean higher perceived pros, higher perceived cons, higher perceived or higher actual self-efficacy, rated self-efficacy. Looking at the adherence measure, as I said, I'm going to be looking at the MMAS-8, 8 item scale, with different, asking about different types of non-adherence that could occur. 7 of them have yes or no items. For example, when you travel or leave home, you sometimes forget to bring along your medications, and one has rated on a 5-point scale from never to all the time. And that is, how often do you have difficulty remembering to take your blood pressure medications? The scoring is proprietary, but when the responses are combined, it comes up with a score ranging between 0 and 8, with higher scores indicating higher medication adherence. And then finally, looking at the KD-QOL-36, as we said earlier, it's derived from the KD-QOL-SF. It replaces the SF-36 with the SF-12. And it has 3 kidney disease targeted subscales. Burden of kidney disease, 4 items, rated from definitely true to false, 5 response options. And an example of one of those is, my kidney disease interferes too much with my life. And they rate, you know, true to definitely true to definitely false. Symptoms, problems with kidney disease scale, 12 items. Rated on not at all bothered to extremely bothered. And an example of that is, to what extent are you bothered by chest pain? And then there's other similar symptoms and problems for the rest. And the final one is the effects of kidney disease. That's 8 items, rated from not at all bothered to extremely bothered again. An example of that is, how much does fluid restriction from kidney disease bother you?
And if you don't hear the fluid restriction, then it doesn't bother you at all.
Yeah.
How much is the, how much wood?
Yeah, well,
fluid restriction bother you?
That probably follows along with stages of CKD pretty well, I would guess.
No, that's good.
So in the SF-12, the physical health component score and mental health component score is generated using their standard orthogonal weighting algorithm. And then it's put on a T-score metric with a mean of 50 and a standard deviation of 10. The KD-QOL-36 subscales do involve reverse coding for several items, and then a linear transformation of each item separately to a 0 to 100 possible range is made, and then responses are averaged. Higher scores for each of them indicate better health related quality of life. Yeah.
So there's no T scores for the KD-QOL-36.
I don't. They're not on a T score. It's an average of a 0 to.
It's not 0 to 100, but. Whereas the SF-12 and SF-36 have.
Yeah, yeah.
Scores with a mean of 50 instead of deviation.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a T score.
That's something you could do in your presentation.
Okay.
You could get your data.
I could.
The thing is, you need the means.
Good idea. Yeah, great to attack. I don't know how we're doing on time. We're pretty good. So I'm going to go through this somewhat quickly. For the treatment decision-making measures, the data were taken from the baseline assessment of a RCT looking at impact of transplant education intervention by Dr. Waterman. This is the sort of analysis sample of 561 dialysis patients from multiple clinics throughout Missouri. Data were collected between 2014 and 2016. and adult white or black patients were eligible. And then there was a restriction on all the patients were recruited from a organization that serves low-income folks, and then the educational intervention is aimed at trying to help specifically low-income folks. So all those who participated had less than 250% of the federal poverty line, and all of them had to be chronic in-center dialysis patients, you know, acute dialysis patients showing up for a day or two. For medication adherence, the data were from Kantar Health, which is a private health care consulting firm. They do large phone and internet panels. The data I have are from the Health and Wellness Survey, the years 2012 and 2013. From those, I selected anyone who indicated having having kidney disease or kidney failure, or how they labeled it. And they recruit, as I say, large panels of adult folks with either chronic or infectious conditions of all stripes, from depression to HIV and comorbidities. That's proprietary data. And then for the health-related quality of life data, I was able to obtain data from the Medical Education Institute. They administer the KDQOL 36 as part of an intervention to improve dialysis patients' health-related quality of life in clinic. So they administer the measure, and then they give like a care plan back to the patient, aiming in and tailoring towards areas that may not be sort of up to par. They provided me with data from a year's data from June 1st, 2015 to May 31st, 2016. And I eliminated from there all pediatric patients and non-unique assessments. And so some patients may do the KDQOL 36 a few times in the course of their care. So I just took the first assessment. To analyze the data, to start looking at the dimensionality of the scales, I first conducted exploratory factor analysis. I used a maximum likelihood estimation with oblique rotation using the PROMAX rotation method. To determine the number of factors, I looked at Gutman's weakest lower bound, eigenvalues over 1, spree test, parallel analysis, and Tucker-Lewis reliability coefficient. I continued on with confirmatory factor analyses, and since the different scales and items I'm working with have a variety of distribution of responses, I looked at a couple different estimation methods. I started with maximum likelihood with polycorrelations. All the items are categorical, but some are even dichotomous, so I also considered asymptotic distribution-free as well to handle that. Model fit was examined with Satori-Bentler chi-square, looking for non-significance, root mean square error of approximation, less than or equal to 0.06, standard root mean square residual, less than or equal to 0.08, and comparative fit index and goodness of fit index, both looking at scores of 0.95 or above. I also looked at dimensionality with items to correlations corrected for overlap using multi-trait scaling. The SAS-MAPRO multi was used and examined the correlation patterns by the hypothesized scales. And I also considered reliability in terms of internal consistency reliability coefficient alpha using the kind of the standard cutoffs and not cutoffs, but this guidelines, rules of thumb. I didn't have a way to look at other types of reliability in the classical test theory paradigm, repeated measures or anything that allowed me to do that. There are lots of IRT analyses I'm going to do, although I'm not going to skip through those, I think, and move towards the data. We've got about 20 minutes left. I'd like to get most feedback on that. So I'm going to do a bunch of IRT analyses as well. In A2, I'm going to look at differential item functioning severity. Oh, sorry, this is. I'm going to look at. I'm not going back for this. Measurement variance and differential item functioning for race, gender, education level, and under other key demos. Measurement and variance will be examined under the.
Good job, sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Classical test theory paradigm. And differential item functioning will be looked at under the IRT analyses. I'm also going to skip the details around that. And then in AIM 3, I'm going to look at the results of AIMs 1 and 2 and make recommendations on alterations and items, items and scales based on the dimensional and factor structure, low factor loadings, scales with low internal consistent reliability, poor discrimination relative to other items, and evidence of measurement and variance. So getting into the data here, this is, I'm just going to show the KDQOL 36 data. I don't have time to show all the rest. But so this is the sample of dialysis patients I have. It's after eliminating PEDs and repeated measures, but more than one measure. I have a little over 70,000 unique assessments, pretty solid. Tended to be about 62 years old, the largest proportion, nearly half were white, although a sizable proportion were black. About 20% were Hispanic or Latino. And most often the measure was administered in English, although with such a large sample, even having 10% in Spanish gives some options for looking at that as well. Almost all, 83% were in-center hemo, although other types of dialysis were used. And the most common access site was fistula, although there were a number of venous catheter and doing PD as well. And a little over half had diabetes as the etiology or cause of ESRD, which is critical because that tends to predict worse outcomes down the road compared to other potential causes like hypertension or PKD. And so that was how this looked. Here are the distribution of scale scores, SF12, PCS, MCS, KDQOL burden, symptoms, and effects. The distributions are good. I'd like to move past that in favor of a comparison to the second biggest analysis I could find. So the CRIC is the chronic renal insufficiency cohort study. And they, you can see the sample sizes differ by these different groups. I could do sort of one-to-one white, Hispanic, English, you know, all that. For now, I just looked at kind of my overall scores versus these different subpopulations, which is how they reported theirs. The PCS and the MCS from the SS12 were pretty on par with that group, that study. But in my group, which is the PEI is my data from the Medical Education Institute, the burden scores, symptoms, problems and scores, and effects scores were much lower, considerably lower. Than each of these groups represented by the CRIC study. So one of the things I'll be doing going forward is trying to compare that to the CRIC's, my sample to the CRIC study sample and understand why my patients seem to be doing a little worse.
Is it dialysis patients?
They're all dialysis. They have to be on chronic. So that's
I administered those to
them. Yeah, in clinic. So it's in accordance with that CMS regulation that right. They have to have a care plan and right. Yeah. So that. That's why doing worse. And so CRIC, although the sample sizes are smaller, is a representative sample. And so I'm gonna be looking at why the scores here are different from those reported by other studies.
So CRIC are not on dialysis.
None are on dialysis?
No.
Oh, I thought that some were on dialysis. Okay, they're all early? Okay, well that's a good explanation.
Sure.
Okay. So looking at the EFA, the top 10, the exploratory factor analysis, the top 10 eigenvalues from the model are shown suggesting potential of four factors. And so I should say these are not including the SF12 items, these are just the subscale items. And so that's a little different than the three factors that we would expect based on the way it's been used thus far. The SCREE test here, you can see most of the action down there is kind of in the 3 to 4 factor range before it flattens out. And it really flattens out actually past 5. So I'd like to compare that to the parallel analysis. Looking here, depending on the criteria, so it looks like there's either kind of indeterminate between 3 and 4 factors. With the the actual scores compared to the simulated scores, so this test works on comparing actual number of factors to a simulated data set, and so all this early stuff kind of shows there could either be three or four factors here, depending on the criteria you use. Let's look at the actual item loading. So the first factor that emerges just is the effect scale, exactly the way that it had been given in the past. So this is the traditional structure. I didn't give the item names, I just gave what they actually are. This is the effect scale. All very high loadings. The second factor is a good portion of symptoms, although one that didn't meet criteria was problems with access or catheter site. And so that there could be some practical reasons for that. It's in the administration of it. It depends on the type of dialysis you do. So that tended to be the worst item going through. So I'm curious. So I'd like to talk to MNI a little bit about the types of responses they get from people and if there could be possible confusions in responding. And then this is the third and fourth items, or factors, I should say, sorry. This first top four items are the burden scale, exactly as it had been in the past. But then there's two that loaded and were highly correlated together, symptoms, dry skin and itchy skin. And that's the fourth factor.
You have the symptoms, is that the second factor?
So they should be with...
Do they have the second factor? Yeah. So they're not even loading that?
No. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like that's like local dependence on us.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's a way to... here's the interfactor correlations. They're pretty strong, and the Tucker Lewis reliability coefficient is a little lower than you would like, but still not terrible, given faith that it's not such a bad model. Now let's look at a three-factor solution. I also want to try that. This is the traditional, scoring, or I should say, dimensionality of the item. So here we have great evidence for that effect scale again, looking good. Same as the third factor. This is the symptoms and problems. The itchy and dry skin are loading fine on it. That access site catheter item still a little out of bounds, but it's not, it's an important, clinically important question. So it'll be curious to, I think one of the major recommendations coming out of it will be how to handle that item in particular and what it means. And then the third factor, the burden scale, looks great. And so the very high factor correlations, and it's slightly lower Tucker Lewis reliability coefficient. So this is a worse model. It likes the four factor better. But I think we can talk later about what it really means. So use the CFA. This is with the maximum likelihood estimation. This is the three factor you saw and the four factor. And I omitted that item 28 out of the four factor because it looks so ugly in that one. Since sample size is so big, I would expect these chi-squares to be significant. The RMSEA, if you remember, we're looking for excellent fit values below 0.06, at or below, so missing the mark a little bit on that. CFIs and GFIs would rather see up in the 0.95 and over range, so those are also a little low. SRMR looks good. These are comparable models. The four factor you can see is a little better, just a little better. And this is the asymptotic distribution free estimation. The RMSEA looks better on these, although the CFI took a nosedive. I'm not sure why that is. There could be good reasons for that, but that's where that landed. And so the GFIs are a little higher. I would say that there's no real advantage to this estimation method.
So it seems like it would be useful to put a three-factor model that allows a correlation, residual correlation between itchy and dry skin.
Those items. And here's the, I'm not going to show the multi-item scaling correlations because we're getting pretty close to being done here, but here's the internal consistency reliability alphas. And so you can see they're fairly comparable. The Symptoms problems, factor two, improves a little bit in the three factor. Just has a few more items in it. So, but they're generally good. And that skin symptoms, just the two items, I mean, he even has a 0.77, so could be much worse for such a small scale. I just wouldn't really be sure what to do with it, I guess, if it was its own scale. So conclusions. I would say the original dimensionality of KD-QoL 36 is largely evidenced, although a few of the fit indices are suboptimal. So I think some of these small changes to the model will probably, in order to get it, back just, across the line where we'd like to see it. But I think the initial work is showing that the way that it's currently being administered is probably the strongest way to do it. You could think about that fourth factor with the itchy, dry skin, but in terms of practical usefulness, this is, a measure that is well used in the clinic. And is there any reason to pull that out and have patients think about that separately from their other symptoms? Be great to have clinical feedback on that. My intuition is that there's probably not, that it probably is they're clearly going to be related to each other, and that's why they're standing out. So after this, I have to proceed with the next aims and look at measurement invariance, and then norms by important clinical subgroups. There has been national norms published by the DOP study for the KD-QoL. But they're a little old now, and so one of the advantages of this large sample would be to use ranking methods to create a sample that reflects the general population of dialysis patients, and then publish some new norms. So that's also of interest to me. And then I'll be looking at all the other measures as well, going through the same process. And with that, I will wrap up, leaving 6 minutes or 7 minutes for questions. Thank you.
So I thought you were going to also, maybe you just didn't mention, but I thought you were also looking into the potential summary scores for the KD-QoL private scales.
Yeah, that I didn't.
One summary score.
Yeah, I haven't. So DOPS, when they administered the KD-QoL 36, and I think at SF, without a lot of psychometric evidence, they just combined all the scales into a component score. So I can't reflect on that in terms of the 11 subscales from the SF, but I could look at if it makes any psychometric sense for these three. I can examine those, and I certainly plan to, although not, in the EFAs, nothing, they didn't load very well on the same factor. So,
but the three, let's say, still three things, they're still fairly highly correlated.
They are. That's true.
Justify the combination of those three things.
Yeah. Well, there certainly be ease of use there. Although I think, especially for the effects and burdens. Although from kind of more practical, I think that having the symptoms separately is a bit of an advantage. And so maintaining that structure is kind of nice in that way. Any other questions?
No. So just the comparison with the prick.
Yeah.
I think, there could be some intrinsic differences just because of the stage. Whereas I think DOPS probably is the one data set that's most comparable. It's the dialysis stage. The challenge with DOPS is most of, I think FCMUS, but a lot of it is international.
It is, yeah.
So there could be some different that may also influence people's perceptions and how they report.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a good. Thanks for the point. I misunderstood the CRIC sample. I thought it had some CKD 4 and 5s in there, but I think
it has 4 and 5, but they're not on that.
They're not. They're all pre-dialysis.
Yeah.
Okay, good to know. All right.
So you said that advanced in terms of numbers, I think, but doesn't DOPS have daily light samples?
They do, but I don't know if they're all published in a way that's easy to do comparisons. So that's another thing that kind of wrangling with the whole DOPS part of it is another part that I need to delve into for this.
It might be nice to make personal contact with them and see if they'll share anything.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the data, but at least the means, because they did share the means, like you said, the old means and standard deviations.
Yeah.
I don't know what the front ones are.
I'm trying to look at whether they, I thought their major administration of the measure was from the SF, although I suppose the subscales, they are the same, so that's still good enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So how much time do you have for
this? Well, this was, yeah, enlightening, because I have about the same amount of time, and I have, this was severely cut down, and I have three other sets of measures to talk about, so I'm going to have to figure
out. Sorry to ask.
No, this is good. So I'm going to have to figure out a way, suggestions on parts that you think are less relevant to prison. I felt like much of it, the literature reviews and things, I was just running through anyway, so.
Well, I don't think you need to do the conceptual stuff very much for this committee, but
exactly. Yeah, okay.
I was going to say that I imagine that the committee, everybody knows what you're talking about, otherwise I would cut a lot or explain more some of the that is very technical statistically, even though we all know, and probably the committee knows, it probably would flow better if you give a little more explanations. Like the model fits, you have five, I think. Is that...
Yeah.
You're just, because of timing, getting the names that are in SAEA, that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe...
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does. Yeah, I can. There's a lot more of that I could get into. This is a highly methodological dissertation.
So. Right, so you cut it or you
sure.
A little...
Sure. Okay. And,
you know, one thing different too is that he's got so much analysis done for a lot of people at the oral stage, they wouldn't be presenting so many results.
Right.
That's a hard challenge.
Yeah. This is not even all of those.
And once
results.
You have it, you want to present all of it. You've got all this work. Who wants to cut?
So that was another thought, is maybe I don't look at all the data, although that's, to be honest, that's my favorite part to talk about.
Right. And you want to show it.
For your committee next week, definitely just stop at the social demographic profile thing.
Okay.
And don't get into the actual results.
Okay.
You're around 30 minutes before you even got into the actual specific aim or the
aims, yeah.
The process, in terms of your protocol, in terms of the analytical approach.
Right, yeah.
So you can probably come back somewhere.
Okay, good. That's good to know. A lot of setup, right.
Yeah, and in terms of results, you might just want to focus on like that one issue with the fit index. DFI was kind of low.
Yeah.
It was okay, because I'm sure Bentler will have.
He'll have, yeah.
Things like that, you want feedback on.
For sure. I'll kind of, yeah. I know he's a big proponent of asymptotic distribution theory. That's why he chose it. He's kind of likes that for.
He's in the committee, so you need to.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially for when we look at the Mariski scale, that would be probably the estimator that he is going to like the most. So. That's right. So the end should be, you know, it's obviously there's tons of great measures in chronic kidney disease, but I'm trying to figure out a way, how do you sort of, you know, so the Katie Qual's landed well. It's in, you know, as you can see, it's in tons of clinics, but especially on the other sides of it, the treatment decision making and patient reported assessment of adherence. How do you show that those are really important determinants? And obviously, I don't have those types of analyses, but everyone knows they're important determinants of quality of life and the outcomes, but are there great measures? Are they used? You know, here's what their properties are, instead of everyone making up their own measures every study that's done, which is kind of the standard practice out there that's now.
Nice work.
Thank you.
Very good.